So last fall, we baptized a couple of college students out at Terry's property in his pond. And Terry let us use his property, but he actually wasn't going to be there that weekend. But he let us use his pond, and he actually offered to let some of the people who were being baptized and baptizing go into his house, shower off, put on dry clothes before they had to drive home, so they didn't have to wear those cold, wet clothes all the way home. So very nice gesture. The problem was we had some miscommunication about how to use his security system. And so we try to go inside, and we set off the alarm, right? So the alarm is going off. I'm calling Terry. Terry's not answering. I'm calling Christy. Christy's not answering. It goes on for several minutes. Finally, the alarm stops ringing, and I'm thinking, we're in the clear. We weren't in the clear. I'm walking out to my car to leave, and here comes a sheriff driving down the road. And he pulls up. And he gets out of his car and he starts to question me, right? And so I'm doing my best to try to explain the whole situation, try to put him at ease, but it becomes very clear that he isn't going to let me off the hook that easy. And that's understandable, right? He doesn't know me from Adam. He doesn't know anything about my character. And even if he did, he is a civil servant that has a clear duty, obligation, and desire to preserve good and punish evil. And unless the owner of the house said that I had the right to be on that property, I was at least trespassing. So I'm trying to convince him that it's okay for me to be there. And thankfully, Terry calls about that time. And I put Terry on speakerphone, and Terry's talking to the sheriff on speakerphone, and he gets me off the hook with the sheriff. But here's what I realized as I was talking to the sheriff, that nothing I said was going to be sufficient to meet his requirements. That nothing I did was going to be sufficient to satisfy his demands. The only thing that was going to put me in right standing was to have the person with the right status, with the right authority, with the right legal backing stand up for me and say, he has the right and the privilege to be here because I said so. And the moment that person spoke on my behalf, the sheriff's whole demeanor changed. No longer did I endure his scorn, now I received his smile. This morning we're going to be looking at most of Hebrews chapter 5, and we're going to explore how Jesus, the great high priest of the new covenant, is better than Aaron, the original high priest of the old covenant. We're going to talk about how Jesus, because he has the right status and the right authority, and the right credentials, is able to mediate for us in a way that Aaron never could. But before we jump into Hebrews 5 this morning, I want to go back to the book of Exodus. Remember, the book of Hebrews was written to a Jewish background Christian community. They were ethnic Jews who had become Christians. And so the author of Hebrews knows the audience that he's writing to, and so he fills this letter with allusions, quotations, and references from the Old Testament, and he just kind of assumes they're going to know what he's talking about, and they're going to pick up on these references. The problem is, sometimes we're not as familiar with the Old Testament. And so if we're not familiar with what he's referring to, we miss out on a lot of richness that he has put into this letter. So if you haven't read the book of Exodus in a while, you'll remember that in the book of Exodus, God delivers his chosen people out of Egypt through a series of plagues, through the Passover, by parting the Red Sea. He leads them through the wilderness by a pillar of fire and a pillar of smoke. He brings them to Mount Sinai, and it's at Mount Sinai that he forms a new covenant with them. He forms them into a nation state, replete with its own legal code and its own set of regulations for conducting religious worship. And those regulations include these instructions for building this mobile sanctuary called the tabernacle, and they also include instructions for designating a select group of men within Israel to perform the religious rites of the tabernacle. And this select group of men would be called the priests. And the first and chief priest among them was Moses' brother, Aaron. And Aaron and his son, as the priests of Israel, were given two key functions. God gave the priests two key functions. The first was to represent God to Israel. They were to mediate between God and Israel. And one of the ways we see this is that God gives instructions for the priest to wear these holy, beautiful, glorious garments that are unlike any other garments in Israel as a visible reminder of his character. So the priests are to put on these robes and turbans and sashes so that when the people look at them, they are reminded of God's holiness, of his glory, of his beauty. So visibly, the priests are to represent God to Israel. But they are also to represent God to Israel in a functional way. See, the priests were given the task of standing between the holy God and these unholy people. They were to be mediators. According to the Old Testament law, only priests were allowed to enter the tabernacle. Only priests were permitted to perform the religious ceremonies. Only the priests could make atonement for sins. You see, in the Old Testament, the common Israelite could not approach God on his or her own terms. They had to go through a priest. The priests represented God to Israel. That was their first key function. The second key function of the priest was to represent Israel to God. So they're supposed to represent God to Israel and Israel to God. I mentioned to you the priestly garments they were supposed to wear. Well, Aaron, the high priest, was to wear something even more special. When he entered the holy place of the tabernacle where God's presence dwelled, he was to wear this special ephod, special robe. And I want you to listen to the description of the ephod as God gives these instructions to Moses, because I think it paints for us a really powerful picture of how the high priest was to represent Israel to God. Exodus 28. "You shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel. Six of their names on the one stone, and the names of the remaining six on the other stone, in the order of their birth. And you shall set the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as stones of remembrance for the sons of Israel. So Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment on his heart when he goes into the holy place to bring them to regular remembrance before the Lord." So I want you to hear me. No one from the tribe of Benjamin was going in the tabernacle. No one from the tribe of Dan could go before the presence of God. No one from the tribe of Gad could approach the holy place. So Aaron did it for them. The high priest was given the charge of representing Israel to God because they couldn't do it themselves. And as he bore their names before God on his shoulders in the tabernacle, he was to offer sacrifices for their sin. That's what God told Moses in Leviticus 7. Moses gives these instructions to Aaron. "Draw near to the altar and offer your sin offering and your burnt offering, and make atonement for yourself and for the people, and bring the offering of the people and make atonement for them as the Lord has commanded." So we have Aaron, uniquely appointed by God from among all the nation of Israel. He's given the task of representing God to Israel and Israel to God. And central to this work that he is to do is to make atonement for Israel's sin. So that's the background. And the author of Hebrews just kind of assumes we know all of that when we jump into Hebrews 5. So we're going to look at Hebrews 5 now, but I want you to keep all of that in your mind. Hebrews chapter 5. Verse 1, "For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, because he's beset with weakness, he's obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was." So the author of Hebrews points out three specific characteristics of Aaron, the high priest of the old covenant. First, the high priest is a man appointed by God. So Aaron didn't get his job by volunteering. He didn't fill out an application, an ASIN interview. This wasn't some act of nepotism by Moses to appoint his brother to a high role. God chose Aaron to be his man. Second thing, the high priest functions to represent men and women to God. We already talked about that, namely through the sacrifice for sin. Third, the high priest, because he himself is a man, can empathize with the people he serves, which is a really good thing for a leader to do. But because he himself is a sinful man, like Aaron, he must offer a sacrifice for his own sins, just as he offers a sacrifice for the sins of the people. So that's how the author of Hebrews begins. And now what he's going to do is he's going to go from the lesser to the greater. He does this a lot through the book of Hebrews. He's shown us what Aaron was like, and now he's going to show us how Jesus is like but unlike Aaron, and how the differences render Jesus far superior. So first, he's going to show us how Jesus, like Aaron, was appointed by God. And to do this, he's going to quote two psalms, Psalm 2:7 and Psalm 110, verse 4. This is Hebrews 5:5. So also, Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." As he says also in another place, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." So Jesus is like Aaron in that he received an appointment from God. He didn't volunteer, he didn't apply, he wasn't voted in, he was appointed by God. But Jesus is unlike Aaron in that he is the only begotten Son of God. And his priesthood is not a temporary priesthood. It's an eternal priesthood. He's a priest forever. And Aaron Lewis has the joy of helping us understand these references to Melchizedek in a couple weeks. So I'm not going to go there. I'll let him handle that. But the first main point here is that Jesus was appointed by God to an eternal priesthood, like but unlike Aaron. Next, the author is going to show us how Jesus is like but unlike Aaron in those other two characteristics, in the way he represents mankind to God and in the way he empathizes with the people he serves. Verse 7, "In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek." So I was reading through this section this past week, and verse 8 and the beginning of verse 9 stood out to me and caused me to stop and ask some questions. Here are the questions I was asking. How can Jesus, who is fully God, the perfect, all-knowing God, learn obedience? Shouldn't he already know? Shouldn't he already have perfect obedience? And if he was already perfect, how could he be made perfect? So I think it's helpful here to remember the immediate context. The author is attempting to show how Jesus is like but unlike Aaron, namely how Jesus is able to empathize with the people that he serves. And this is what I think the author of Hebrews is saying, and I think it's important for us to understand that although Jesus is perfect, he is the perfect all-knowing God and fully so, in the days of his flesh, Jesus was encountering new temptations and new trials, temptations and trials that he had never encountered previously until he took on human flesh. And it was necessary for Jesus to enter into these temptations and trials in order that he would be qualified for the position of great high priest. And it was necessary for two reasons. The first is because a high priest has to be able to empathize with those he serves. In order to be able to empathize with the fallen humanity, Jesus needed to encounter the same kind of suffering and the same kind of temptation that we encounter. And before taking on human flesh, Jesus dwelled in perfect, righteous, eternal fellowship with the Father and the Spirit, unaffected by this realm of brokenness and decay. So what that means is that when he took on flesh, he encountered this brokenness and this decay in a new way. For the first time, he personally experienced the suffering and the temptation that we experience on a daily basis. And this is what the author of Hebrews is saying, that Jesus' obedience and perfection met and far exceeded even these new trials and temptations. His level of obedience and perfection didn't change, it was simply proven in a new way. We have a consistent flow of aerospace students that come through Challenge in our church. Any aerospace students? There we go, Tate. So if you don't know any aerospace students have this year-long project at the end of their senior year where their professor assigns them the task of building a small RC plane that can accomplish some arbitrary task that the professors come up with. And so they're put on these teams and they spend all year running calculations, gluing balsa wood, soldering circuits until finally, toward the end of the year, the plane is complete. And if you were there on the day that the plane was finished and you asked Tate, can your plane fly? He would tell you, yes, it can fly. And you would ask him, well, how do you know it can fly? Tate, it's never been in the air. And he would say, because we've done all the math. We've double-checked, we've triple-checked, we glued this balsa ourselves, we soldered these circuits, we've been meticulous, this plane will fly. They have confidence in their work before it's ever tested. But before they get a passing grade, that plane has to get up in the air. They actually have to go fly it. And flying it is a new and different kind of test. But here's the thing, it doesn't change anything about the plane. The plane could always fly. It's just being proven in a new way. And that's what the trials and temptations did for Jesus' perfect righteousness and obedience. They changed nothing, they proved everything. And they qualified him to be a high priest. Because they equipped him to empathize with us and to offer a worthy sacrifice on our behalf. A sacrifice that was totally unlike anything Aaron could ever offer. Verse 9 says, Jesus became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Aaron, in his old covenant ministry, continuously offered these temporary reprieves from the guilt of sin by sacrificing bulls and goats. He did this first for his own sin and then for the sins of the people. But Jesus offered an eternal pardon from the guilt of sin, once and for all, by sacrificing himself. In Hebrews 10, we'll get there in a few weeks, the author writes this, day after day, every priest stands and performs his religious duties. Again and again, he offers the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when this priest, Jesus, had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. And since that time, he waits for his enemies to be made his footstool. For by one sacrifice, he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. Jesus, like Aaron, represents men and women to God. But unlike Aaron, the sacrifice Jesus offers renders an eternal for salvation for those who will trust in him by faith and obediently follow him. Jesus is far greater than Aaron. So now as we move toward applying this truth to our lives, I actually want to go backward in the text. We're going to go back to Hebrews 4, the last three verses. Jim mentioned them last week. Hebrews 4, verse 14. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So there are two points of application right here in the scriptures. The first one is this in verse 14. Let us hold fast our confession. Since we have a great high priest like Jesus, let us hold fast our confession. The Greek word for confession here is a noun. It's a noun that refers to a declaration of belief, a set of beliefs. Let us hold fast our declaration of beliefs about the Christian faith, those beliefs that we draw directly from the Old and New Testaments. Now, I don't need to say this, you all know this, but we live in a society that attacks the very idea of truth. To hold tightly to any concrete body of beliefs is dangerous territory if you want to make friends with the culture at large. If you hold fast your confession, you will not make it long before you're labeled close-minded, uneducated, insensitive, barbaric. There might even be some people within the modern American church who will call you a Pharisee or a Biblicist or something like that. And when that happens, I want you to know that you are not encountering anything new. In fact, the people to whom the author of Hebrews was writing would probably envy the relative ease by which we hold fast our confession. They were facing intense persecution. They were losing their jobs. They were losing their homes. They were being thrown in prison. They were being kicked out of town. And that's happening in places in our world today. We might face an inconvenience here or there. And I don't say that to induce shame. I say that to help us with perspective, to inspire courage. If they held fast their confession, then we can too. And we must. You know, there are some modern iterations of Christianity that have done away with their confession. Either in whole or in part, they've kind of moved away from holding to a confession. And instead, they've started to emphasize an experience with Christ or an encounter with Christ. And the experience with Christ is really where the true truth is at. And it's kind of detached from these beliefs. But that belief quickly spirals into subjectivity and into all sorts of deviations from historic Christianity. And I want you to hear me say this. Yes, Christianity is about a relationship with God. Okay, hear me say that. It's about a relationship with the living God. But it is a relationship that is established through concrete events in history, and it's communicated through the concrete words of Scripture. And if we let go of the confession, we let go of Christ. So if we can't let go of the confession, what do? We hold fast our confession, but we do it with a smile. We close one hand around a sure confession, and we open the other hand to care for a world that is collapsing on itself and has no way to save itself. We close the door on the beliefs of the world, but we open it to the very people who hold them. And we show them and we tell them about the great high priest who's better than anything the world has ever known. Second application. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Anybody here in a time of need? Anybody like some help? Want to find grace? Want to receive mercy? I think that's probably all of us. Here's what all this great high priest talk means. It means that whatever trial or temptation you face this morning, that you can bring it before the Almighty God who made you and who loves you. And you're bringing it to a throne of grace. Not a throne of condemnation. Not a throne of judgment, a throne of grace. And you can bring it with confidence. Why? Because you have a great high priest appointed by the Father who can sympathize with your weakness and who mediates on your behalf. So I don't know what you're carrying this morning. Maybe you are under fire in some way for your faith, from your family members, your friends, your coworkers. Maybe you're facing a different trial. Maybe you have some chronic disease that you carry in silence day after day. Maybe you're dealing with infertility. Maybe you're in the dark pit of depression, or you're racked with anxiety. Maybe you're wrestling with same-sex attraction or a pornography addiction. Maybe there's nothing especially bad about your life right now. You're just tired of day to day going to work, raising kids, fixing leaky faucets, paying bills. Whatever the situation, one thing that trials and temptations tend to rob us of is confidence. Trials and temptations usually leave us with doubt, with fear, and with shame. Privately or publicly, maybe we start asking questions. Is God real? Is he trustworthy? Is following him really worth it? Would he really love me if he knew that I struggled with this? Will all of this sacrifice of my time and my energy and my resources be worth it in the end? And we wonder these things as we doubt, as we have fear, we have shame, and sometimes we don't even bring them before God because we don't feel like we can be honest with him. We never really show him our feelings, our true self, because of fear. But can I tell you something? That we hold fast a confession. And our confession tells us that we can approach with confidence. Not a confidence in ourselves. Not a confidence that we can say the right thing or do the right thing. A confidence that we have a great high priest with the right status, with the right authority, and with the right credentials to stand in the gap for us and declare he has the right to be here. She has the privilege to be here because I said so. And that's good, good news. Let's pray. I'll just give you some time to talk to God. And I just want to encourage you to draw near to him with confidence, with whatever you're carrying this morning, and receive grace and mercy for your time of need.